Spirit Radio Podcasts.
Now, the Calthorpe Clinic in Edgbaston in suburban Birmingham in England was originally run as an old people's home. But in 1969, it switched to a completely different activity, becoming the first centre in the UK to exist exclusively for abortions. But this week, it has emerged rather unexpectedly that the centre is closing down completely. This is being hailed as a miracle by people who have been praying outside the centre for literally decades. On the line now to tell us more, we have Isabel Vaughan Spruce, Campaign Director for 40 Days for Life Birmingham. You're very welcome to the show, Isabel. How are you?
Thank you. Good to be on. Yes. Hi, Ronan.
Yeah. So first of all, Isabel, what was the Calthorpe Clinic?
It was a huge abortion centre. Originally, it was a private abortion centre. At its peak in 2007, it was the busiest abortion centre in the UK, performing about 10,000 abortions a year.
My goodness.
Then it was taken over by Mary Stopes, and even the recent figures of 5,000 a year put it in the top five abortion centres in the UK.
Like 10,000 abortions a year out of one place? That is just
it's unbelievable, really, isn't it?
So how did the news emerge that it was closing?
Very unexpectedly, the manageress of the abortion centre on the 12th of December, which is a significant feast day for many Catholics, she came out of the abortion centre with donuts and announced that the clinic would be closing at the end of the month.
My goodness, your prayers have been answered. Your prayers have been answered, my friends. Have some donuts. That's bizarre, isn't it?
That's pretty much what happened.
My goodness. Now, I know that, you've run many 40 Days for Life campaigns, and this was, you know, kind of the first one where no woman decided not to have an abortion. This is extraordinary, really. You know, what reasons do they give for closing?
They just said that they hadn't renewed their contract with the NHS, and when I asked more, they just said, things are changing. Make of that what you will. A lot of the staff there will now obviously be out of work, so it'd be good to keep them in prayer.
Yes, exactly,
some of them have actually specifically come and asked us for prayer.
Yeah.
So it would be really good to pray that they can find work in actually sort of more life-saving occupations.
Yeah, for sure. I mean, I suppose nobody goes into any of those occupations to want to kill. What was the nature of the vigils held by pro-life advocates outside the clinic?
So there's been people praying there one way and another for probably about 30 years, but for the last 8 or so years, we've been running a 40 Days for Life campaign, which I'm sure a lot of people are familiar with, where for 40 consecutive days, 12 hours a day, we pray peacefully for an end to abortion and offer alternatives to those going in who are considering abortion, as well as offering help to coming out who've had an abortion as well. So we run that in Lent, which is sort of in springtime, and then again in autumn we run another 40 days there, along with many people around the world who join in doing the same thing.
And you do know of women who decided not to have abortions there and children who are now alive because of these vigils?
Yeah, I mean, we know a good 100 women or so who've changed their mind because of the support they've been offered. I mean, just recently I was sent a lovely photo of somebody whose child's now 5, and they sent a little photo of, you know, him in his school uniform.
Wow.
You know, I remember one particular story that really touched me when a family that I spoke to decided to keep their baby, and when they named the child in their own language, they called the child Miracle.
Wow.
Because they said that was what the child was to them, you know, something very, very special.
Yeah. So, I mean, is your sense that these abortions will just be carried out elsewhere, or what way does it work, do you know?
Obviously, we're not under any illusions that abortion isn't still available in Birmingham, but the fact that this hugely busy place has closed down is quite definitely an answer to prayer, and I think the temptation to think otherwise is just that, a temptation. I think anything that makes it more difficult for a woman to have an abortion, whether it's that she has to travel further or wait longer, gives her that time to think and the time for real help to be offered to her. I mean, in this country, we have laws that try and make it difficult for people who maybe in a moment of desperation might be considering taking their own life.
Yeah.
Just small laws like, you know, making it illegal to buy more than 2 packets of paracetamol at once, things like that.
Yeah.
And I think equally, for people who are in a moment of desperation might be considering taking their child's life, we need to make things more difficult for them and try and get real help to them, just like we would if it was their own life they were taking.
Yeah, I know what you might mean. That I mean, it often happens too, doesn't it, in the area of suicide. If you can create a pause that gives people a chance to just to think and to process for a moment they make it
and
up
for
with
real
a
help
answer.
To get to them as well, so that they can really get the support they need. Because it's surprising how many people involved in our campaign are actually post-abortive themselves. These are women or men who've had abortions and have come to join us because they realise it didn't really fix their problems; it just created other problems.
Yeah.
And I think if that could message could only get out to people more, that although people might be meaning well when they think they're giving women access to abortions, if they actually could see the other side of it. And the hurt and the damage and the pain that it causes these women, it's not really helping women at all.
Yeah, I was actually amazed. I just saw some statistics recently from Planned Parenthood, and these were their statistics. Now, these weren't kind of pro-life statistics by any manner or means, but they were saying that something like, they were making the point that 28% of people who get abortions don't have any remorse afterwards, but there was an implication that there was, you know, 72% of people that were deeply and painfully impacted by it. You know, a massive
Yeah, like
number.
You say, if those figures are coming from Planned Parenthood themselves,
exactly.
And of course, you know, it's understandable that people will justify any decision that they make. That's part of human nature.
Sure.
Until, you know, it takes a big step to say I've made a wrong decision.
It
takes a lot of courage and humility and soul searching to be able to do that.
It sure does.
So it's understandable that a lot of people aren't yet in that position.
Did you say that the people who are working in the centre had asked for prayer for to help get new jobs? Is that what you said to you?
Yeah, it was. It's interesting.
Amazing.
First of all, the manageress herself, she was saying, these are her own words, not mine, but she was saying that, she said, in some difficult situations I can understand abortion, she said, but not the sort of things that's happening here with lots of repeat abortions.
Yeah.
So she herself wasn't really happy with what was actually happening at her own abortion centre.
Says a lot,
and on
it?
The very, very last day, at the end of December, two of the nurses came out and actually said, would you pray for us because we're now going to be out of work.
Wow.
So it was nice that there was that lack of animosity there, really, from the staff.
It's kind of an understanding of what your position was, almost, that they could even come and ask for prayer is extraordinary to me. It just shows you that
there
was
witness
in it, you know.
Definitely. We try and make it very clear that we're not there in a spirit of hate. You know, we don't judge them. Obviously, we judge what they're doing is very wrong, but not them. And, you know, we always wonder if that message actually gets across. And I think, you know, this has really shown that. I mean, on one of the last days, I went into the abortion centre to talk to the staff there. And I felt like I was welcomed like an old friend. It was amazing how friendly they were towards me there. Which isn't what you see in the media when they talk about how, you know, we need buffer zones because staff are feeling intimidated and harassed by these people outside the abortion centre. That wasn't the experience I got when I talked to staff. You know, they were very, very warm and friendly towards me.
Yeah, there's something very similar to what you're describing going on here in Ireland with what is, I suppose, a very new abortion regime, and it's there's a lot of skin and hair flying. I mean, here in Ireland, our Minister for Health would like to bring in legislation to enforce what he calls safe access zones around hospitals and even GP practices that carry out abortions. What's your own feeling on that?
I think it's really sad that we can't even be there to offer an alternative to women going in. There's already existing laws against harassment, against intimidation. And if actions like that were happening, people could recourse to those laws, but they don't, because it isn't happening. You know, even in England, where, you know, abortion's been legal for 50 plus years, you know, you never hear of actually a case where somebody has been prosecuted for, you know, attacking or abusing somebody outside an abortion centre. It just doesn't happen. It's all hyped by the people who support abortions. In actual fact, you know, as we see, a lot of women accept our help because we are so approachable, because we're not there screaming at them and, you know, waving offensive placards in their face. If we were doing that, they wouldn't come to us for help, you know. So it's just not what happens at all.
So, Isabel, what does the closure of the Calthorpe Clinic mean for pro-life advocates in the UK?
I think it's actually a real sign for us of who is ultimately in control, and that is God. I think this has really been an answer to prayer. People have been faithfully coming there for decades. And as you mentioned earlier, it was this last campaign, it was the only campaign of all the 40 days we've had where we didn't actually see any women change their mind. And people were saying to me, why has nobody changed their mind this time? You know, are people not listening to us? And I was actually saying to them, it's when it seems like things are very quiet that actually God is working the deepest. He works best in silence. And I think it's also true for our whole country. When it seems like we're in the complete darkness at the moment with the laws that are happening, things that are going through Parliament, whether it's here or over in Ireland, with laws that may be changing there that don't seem for the good at the moment, we've got to remember that ultimately God is in control and we just need to stay faithful.
Amen to that. Isabel Vaughan Spruce, Campaign Director for 40 Days for Life Birmingham, thank you so much for talking to us today.
Thank you for having me on. God bless.
For many, Christmas is one of their favourite times of the year, but we also need to be mindful that it is also one of the most wasteful times of the year, and it is estimated that we've generated approximately 75,000 tonnes of packaging waste this Christmas. So, with Christmas over and the decorations coming down, what are the do's and don'ts for recycling after Christmas? And what can we learn from this Christmas waste to help us reduce waste throughout the year? On the line now, we have, to tell us more, we have Elaine Phillips, Head of Marketing and Communications at Repack. You're very welcome to the show, Elaine. How are you?
Thank you, Ronan. I'm good, thanks.
Yeah. So first of all, Elaine, as a nation, how wasteful are we over Christmas and New Year?
Well, every year we measure the increase in waste over Christmas, and normally we see about a 10% increase in waste over Christmas. That specifically, Repack specifically manages packaging waste and the collection of packaging waste. So this year, yeah, we expected that Ireland would generate about 75,000 tonnes over a three-week period. We don't have all the numbers in yet to tell you whether that was actually the case. But it is a significant increase every year, and we see a bigger increase in some materials, like obviously glass, with a lot of bottles being used, and cardboard as well, particularly related to online shopping. So it is important that over the Christmas period, well, before even, that people are thinking about how they can reduce what they buy and how they think about, you know, if an item that you're purchasing is recyclable. But seeing as we're after Christmas now, it's a bit late for that for last year, but even for next year. And also to think about what you can reuse. So things like tins from gifts, and gift bags from Christmas presents that you got. Some people are not wrapping presents anymore, they're just using gift bags. They can all be reused again and again. So it's just to be mindful of those things and then to look at how you can recycle as much as possible and as best as possible. So I can give you lots of tips on that, which would be useful hopefully to your listeners.
Great. So with taking down the Christmas tree and decorations this week, give us some ideas about the best ways to recycle after Christmas.
Well, the best way to recycle overall, I suppose, is to know firstly what you can recycle, and then secondly to know how you should recycle. Now, the go-to resource for information on recycling is mywaste.ie. So this is the government-funded website. It's run by all the local authorities in Ireland, and it was previously called Recycling List Ireland. So mywaste.ie has all the information on where the facilities are locally, and it has all the information on what you can recycle, and that's the official information across the whole country, and how you should recycle. So I suppose at a basic level, there are three different kind of categories of material. The first is cardboard and paper. The second is metals, which is tins and cans and aluminium products. And the third is plastics, but you can only currently put rigid plastics in your recycling bin. You have to put soft plastics in your general waste, and some facilities, some civic amenities will take quantities of soft, very clean soft plastics, like, you know, that you get around bigger items of packaging. They'll take those as well. So that's the very, at a very basic level, what you can put in the bin, and under each of those headings then there's obviously a whole range of items. We're very good at recycling most materials, particularly good at recycling glass. So as a nation, we hit a recycling rate of 86% of glass against an EU target of 50 or 60.
My goodness.
Yeah, so actually we're doing very well, and people are very good at going to the bottle banks over Christmas, or they can be overflowing, and you can push things into them to get a bit more space. People are very good in Ireland at recycling glass. It's a useful tip for people to know that you can leave metal lids on your glass items
when
you're recycling them.
Never knew that.
Yeah, and it's very handy as well if you rinse out something and you're putting it in whatever you're using to collect your glass in your kitchen, whether it's a box or you know, a bin or whatever, that you can screw the jar lid back on, and that just makes it all very much easier for you when they're then depositing it in the glass recycling, because those metal lids are picked up they're recycled.
Of course,
that's a little tip for people. But Irish people are very good at recycling glass. Obviously, online shopping generates a whole heap of extra cardboard. We did a study back in November, and online shopping from international retailers is bringing about an extra 12,000 tons of packaging waste into Ireland every year. And none of those retailers, a couple of them are actually contributing into Repack. So just to explain, Repack basically is an environmental not-for-profit organisation with a social mission. And it was set up 22 years ago to help businesses who place packaging on the market to meet their obligation to recycle that packaging. So any manufacturer, any retailer that places packaging on the market of a certain amount and with a certain turnover must either join Repack, or they can go another route of self-compliance, but most of them join Repack. And that means that then they pay fees to us, and we use those fees to fund the household recycling bin, the bottle bank, the civic amenities. A lot of people aren't fully familiar with what Repack does. We don't actually do the recycling ourselves, but we oversee that whole infrastructure in Ireland. So packaging is our speciality, and we see that this increase in online packaging coming in, and 75% of that is cardboard.
Yeah.
So if you think of that in a year, it's quite a significant amount, and over Christmas that goes up. So it's just for people to be mindful, if you can't fit it in your green bin this time around, or whatever colour your recycling bin is, keep it for the next one. A lot of the collectors will actually take extra items once they're dry.
That's right, I said, try and keep it dry in the meantime is the big thing, isn't it?
Exactly, yeah. And everything should go into your recycling bin, clean, dry and loose.
And you know, when I see wrapping paper, I'm like, great, at least that can be recycled. But I've heard that even that is sometimes untrue. Is that...
Yeah, it can only be, wrapping paper can only be recycled if it is paper.
Pure paper,
only.
Yeah.
So there's a couple of ways of checking that. There's the scrunch test, which is scrunch it up, and if it stays in a ball, it's paper only.
Okay.
If it pops back out, it's got metal or plastic. Or you can try and tear it. And if you can't tear paper with your hands, then it's not just paper.
Sure.
So there are a couple of tests. So, you know, people need to be mindful of that too. Obviously, a lot of people by now will have already disposed of their wrapping paper. But even for next year, people are moving away from the more complex wrapping paper. And people are looking at alternative ways of wrapping with brown paper and string and not going for all the fancy adornments and the rosette.
Which is lovely, isn't it? You know, the paper and string is gorgeous. It's really attractive.
Gorgeous.
Yeah, yeah.
There are lots of ways of wrapping gifts that can be then reused, even just using gift bags. Pop a little bit of tissue paper in the top to hide what it is, and the surprise is still there.
Yeah.
So there are a whole load of ways. But around Christmas, there are lots of items that maybe people don't even think about that are recyclable. So, for example, your tubs of sweets, your tins of biscuits, all of those items. Now, they can be reused if you want to reuse your tins or your tub. Those plastic tubs with the plastic lids that all the sweets come in now, they're all fully recyclable. And plastics are the material that we really need to do better on. We're lagging behind on plastic compared to everything, and other countries are too, but we're only currently at 33% recycling against an EU target of 22.5%.
Is that because so much of the kind of plastics that we use is not really, at least at the moment, particularly recyclable?
It is recyclable. I think the problem is that people don't actually know what they can recycle.
Okay.
Because there's a huge range of rigid plastics, and if you look at mywaste.ie, you can see the full list. So everything from your bottle, from your 2-litre bottle, from your milk, your tubs, from ice cream, from margarine, anything that's a hard plastic, make sure that if it's plastic from the kitchen, needs to be rinsed and
cleaned.
Dry.
Yeah,
it doesn't
sure.
need to be 100% pristinely clean, but it needs to not leak, because if it leaks onto the paper and the cardboard, they get soggy and they get moldy. Yeah, and that
contamination, exactly. I was even thinking something as simple, and it is confusing, but you know, if you for instance, even have you like cold meat, and cold meat will be in, it'll be, it, the top of it will be, you know, a piece of plastic, which is kind of, you know, a softer plastic,
which you
won't be able to recycle, but the bottom of it will be recyclable. And it's confusing. I think this is where some of the confusion can happen, where I have to get the first one and put that into the bin, but the bottom part, give it a little bit of a wipe, that can go into recycling.
Exactly. Yeah. Once it's dry, once it's clean and dry, it goes in, and you shouldn't be putting anything into plastic bags in your recycling bin. You should be putting everything in loose.
Yeah.
You'll fit a lot more in your bin if you do that, and sure. That's for a very valid reason. Firstly, cuts off plastic shouldn't go in the recycling bin, and secondly, when all the material goes into the recycling facility, it needs to be loose because the machinery and the hand picking needs to access everything quickly to, you know, there are amalgamates pulling out the metals, and it's quite a complex procedure. So if they're in bags, those all have to be torn open, they can get caught in the machinery, and it just complicates everything.
Absolutely.
So we ask people to put everything in the bin loosely once they're clean and dry. And just for people to know as well, regarding plastics outside of the kitchen, there are a multitude of different bottles and containers that people can put in the recycling bin. All of your plastic containers from detergents.
And people forget the bathroom, don't they? Like all the shampoo bottles, they forget that.
Exactly, yeah, all of those. And they don't have to be rinsed out. Don't waste water rinsing them. Yeah. Make sure they're empty. Keep the lids on any bottles that you put in the recycling. Any plastic bottles, whether they're beverage bottles or milk bottles or bottles from shampoo, keep the lids on. And then if there is a drip of something left in it, it's not going to leak out. So that's, you know, a very quick kind of guide to how to do it. But people, if everyone thinks of all of those extra items beyond the kitchen, we could probably all double our recycling of plastics very, very quickly. And it's just a matter of bringing things down and putting them in their recycling bin, or having another, you know, way of collecting them upstairs somewhere, you know, that you just keep another little bin somewhere and you just put everything in there. It's just a habit that people need to get into. But it is really great if people can up their game in that area, because we need to hit very ambitious, I mean, they don't sound ambitious, 50% by 2025.
But we're well behind at the moment.
A very reasonable number, but we're only at 33.
Yeah.
We need
it's a long way to go. Yeah.
Our race every year. And every time we recycle plastics, we're contributing towards preventing more, you know, virgin plastics being used. We're all trying to stop raw materials being taken from the earth. So that's what we need to be thinking about, that it's about, you know, keeping that plastic in circulation, because it can be recycled.
Great. Elaine Phillips, Head of Marketing and Communications at Repack, thank you so much for speaking to us today.
Thanks God very much, Alan.
Thank you. Bye-bye. Now, about a year ago, Gillette brought out an ad that highlighted many of the worst stereotypes of men. It drew a lot of criticism for reinforcing a growing perception that there is something inherently unhealthy about masculinity. So, is all masculinity toxic? And what's the best way to respond in a positive way to this pervasive negativity towards masculine characteristics? On the line now from Washington, D.C. to discuss, we have a clinical psychologist and director of the Marriage and Religion Research Institute, MARI, Dr. Pat Fagan. You're very welcome to the show, Pat. How are you?
I'm great. Good to be with you. Good to be talking to Dublin and Ireland.
First of all, Pat, where has this emergence of this notion of toxic masculinity come from?
Well, really from the radical feminist wing. It's been in the making for a long time. The radical Marxist critique of society was brilliant, actually, in its perceptiveness. Back, I would say they really achieved what Marxism had been looking for a long time in the late 60s, early 70s, when they identified what in their terms, the patriarch, as the enemy of, or the lynch, the enemy of what they were about, and the linchpin of, let's call it, a Christian culture, and set out to remove the patriarch from the family. There's no doubt about that. Anybody who's dug into the history, evidence is overwhelming. This was very deliberate. And this is the latest iteration of that agenda unfolding over the last 50 years.
So really what you're saying, it's not something that's happened just by chance or circumstances.
Oh,
there was a concerted effort, a concerted, you know, a choreographed, planned attack on masculinity.
Sure. Actually, the most obvious evidence of that now are the women's study centers across the world. We have 680 different women's study centers at universities across the U.S. I think you have three or four in Ireland.
Sure, yeah.
If you look at the agenda and the studies there, how is the married father of the family, and particularly the married father who worships weekly, how is he regarded? actually, that's where you have the least toxicity and the greatest amount of everything that the feminists say they want. The social science data, again, is overwhelming. But, of course, that is not the interest here at all. The answer lies, actually, the answer lies in virtue. You want good men. You want big, magnanimous men, men who honor women. Actually, of course, the other part that's central to a society working well, and this is going to sound strange, is the centrality of both motherhood and virginity. Virginity protects motherhood, and, you know, talking and asking for those in modern society and modern Ireland,
you'd be laughed at.
You'd be laughed at, but... And here's where the social scientists it takes a bit of courage to be a good social scientist today, because the data is overwhelming and is not at all welcome. Look, toxic masculinity does exist in spades, and we have more and more of it. Why? Because the two fundamental things, the big thing, lack of love. When a child is young, when a boy is young, he needs a great father who's going to be attached to him, assuming he already has a great mother who's very attached to him. They are the two big conditions for a boy to grow into being the man you would want your daughter to marry. And that's the way to put it. How do you grow young men that you want your daughters to marry, that you want to be the father of your grandchildren? And when you look at the data, it's pretty clear. First of all, if they don't start off in a married family, if their mom and dad are not married at birth, cohabiting, or break up, the boy already has big marks against him. It's the difficulty of becoming a magnanimous man has been massively increased for him. You look at the abuse data here, and we have the best data in the world. You look at the U.S. survey on this, the abuse of women and children is 20 times higher in the family where the mother's cohabiting with a boyfriend who's not the natural father of the child. 20 times higher than in the intact married family.
It's amazing, isn't it?
This is another thing. The data is overwhelming. But, and to come back to the Women's Studies Center, I've never looked at the Women's Studies Centers in Ireland and what their agenda and their courses are. But I'd probably win the bet if I were to say, you know, I bet you $1,000 you're not going to find this sort of data in their curriculum.
Yeah, I know. And it's not that the data isn't available, it's just the interpreters of the data don't probably like certain parts of it, I presume.
Oh, not only not like certain products, they would be hostile to it. God help you if you bring it up.
Can I just ask
you? Your academic career would be over.
Yeah.
There's a hostility to data. This is not benign.
You think about the vulnerability of somebody who's studying at doctorate level, and you know the panel. If all the panel is set against you, you know you could be saying goodbye to 4 or 5 years of research, and just have throw it out. And I can imagine that you're at a particularly vulnerable point at that stage. And can I just ask you about kind of what we would describe as male qualities? Like last year, the American Psychological Association, the APA, brought out guidelines for psychological practice with men and boys, which was heavily criticised here in Ireland by Professor Patricia Casey, who said it would give the toxic masculinity hypothesis the status of infallibility. You know, could you talk about these guidelines and maybe some of the male qualities that the APA consider problematic? I mean, I'm thinking about, you know, not showing vulnerability or emotional stoicism or self-reliance or competitiveness, which we would have considered kind of, I suppose, benignly in the past, are now being considered to be problematic.
Yeah, first of all, one of the big things, the British Psychological Association totally rejects the American Psychological Association's report, totally.
That's interesting now.
That's well worth exploring. Why? Because, look, this is not, the study group that came up with this report, there's not a prominent social scientist on it. Their data is awful. they avoid massive amounts of the psychological research and the sort of stuff that I was talking about. It's a sham. It's a disgrace. That's the biggest way to... And the prima facie evidence of it is that just interview the British Psychological Association and get their critique of the American Psychological Association report. Enough said.
It's funny, you know, we were only talking recently with Dr. Peter Taylor here, and he's coming from a completely different area of science. He's coming from astrophysics. But one of the things that he said is, you know, an awful lot of the time you end up with the data being analysed and commented on by people who this particular area isn't their area. I mean, they may well be professors or have doctorates or whatever, but this is not their area. So they don't understand the meaning of the data. So you end up with people commenting on it and almost distorting what it means.
Yes, that's true. But in this case, I'm going further. These are academics who produce this report. They are academics of no standing. When I say they do have standing. But they're not very prominent academics. They haven't published great research in these areas. And the great research in these areas, they've totally neglected. I would like to flip this actually on its head. Because if you look at it, the issues to be concerned about in toxic masculinity are abuse, the abuse of women, the use of women sexually, and then casting them aside. But also to look at, are we producing, and I think the evidence is overwhelming, a toxic femininity. Ireland has advanced massively in toxic femininity.
Of course, yeah.
And they both come from the same sources. The lack of love within the family, the dedication of mom and dad to each other, that's hard work to get, you know, over time. Anybody who's been married for any length of time knows that, you know, once the honeymoon phase is over, then the real work begins of building unity in all the areas, in finance, in raising the kids, and getting the kids a good education, and dad getting home from work, giving time to the kids, giving time to the mother. The mother's the same thing, the achievement of balance in work and home. All of that takes a tremendous amount of work, a tremendous dedication. This is where I say the answer actually lies in growing what I call magnanimity. I think it's the byword of the new culture we have to grow. You want magnanimous men. You want that's big-hearted. People who struggle to give. First of all, to their spouses, and then to their children. That takes a huge amount of work. That's the society we need to be dedicated to. If you pose a negative and say we're against abuse, we're against abortion, we're against this, I don't care what side you're on, left or right, being against stuff does no good.
Yeah, that's so true. Yeah, it doesn't create anything positive and achievable. It's just being opposed to things, you know, setting yourself up as what you're against. So I'm interested in this idea of magnanimity, and I understand too that the most magnanimous people really have a good grounding in love, as you describe, you know, whether that is they've been raised in a loving place, they have a good understanding of love themselves, and probably are loving people themselves. But why do you think society needs men be magnanimous and comfortable in their own skins?
Well, the same as the reason why they need women who are.
Yeah.
And, you know, you have a complementarity here, actually, all the time. Who produces the men? Well, the first producer, if I put it, is the woman, the mother.
Yeah.
Now, it takes mom and dad, or the father and the mother, the sexual intercourse. But the mother is the first producer. So, the magnanimous man and woman, the magnanimous marriage, the magnanimous family is essentially big-hearted and striving to grow that in their children. And a magnanimous person, first of all, strives for greatness. So competitiveness is part of that. You're competing really with yourself to become great. The guy, the woman, they study well so that they can be good providers later. They're good with their friends, they're kind in their family. The growing of kindness in the family between brothers and sisters is a key preparation for marriage. And the wise parent doesn't see just the 3-year-old or the 7-year-old in front of them. They see the 25-year-old. And they say, wait now, if my kid keeps doing this, be it my daughter or my son, they're not going to make good spouses later. They're going to make their spouse very unhappy if they keep these habits going. So we got to replace the fallen human nature that comes out at every child and gradually lead them on through love, through affection, which really means time with, and particularly when they're young, time playing with them. That's how the bond of affection grows between particularly father and child.
Yeah.
Is all the time he spends playing with them, reading to them, bringing them out on hikes, etc.
Yeah.
That takes a lot of sacrifice on the fathers.
It sure does, and yeah. Yeah, and maybe a sacrifice that many fathers sometimes are either too busy or too distracted to make, but you realize how absolutely essential it is. Dr. Pat Fagan, I know that we've got you out of bed very early in the morning, and I do appreciate you taking this call, but thank you, Dr. Pat Fagan, Director of the Marie Institute in Washington, D.C. Thank you so much for talking to us this morning.
It's great to be in with you.
God bless you. Bye-bye.
Thanks for listening to our Spirit Radio podcast. Don't miss out. Subscribe today. Find out how at spiritradio.ie.